You're listening to a Mutiny Transmission.
You can find more podcasts, videos, books, comics, and records online at mutinyinfocafe.com.
Or just stop in the store in Denver and have a coffee sometime.
Yes, this is so anticlimactic. Hi, welcome. Thank you, everybody, for coming. This is Hello, Denver, Are You Still There? A podcast about Denver with awesome people from Denver that are doing incredible things. So there's my friend Deacon. So many cool people are here. Amazing. Okay, so I'm going to have you guys introduce yourselves, but if you would just start. And
sure. I mean,
we know who you are, but you're kind of important.
Okay.
So.
Well, I am State Representative Leslie Harrod. I represent House District 8. Thank you. I represent Central and Northeast Denver, and I am the first African-American LGBT person to hold office in Colorado, openly LGBT person to hold office in Colorado, and I'm happy to be here tonight.
Thank you.
My name is Lisa Rayville. I'm the Executive Director of the Harm Reduction Action Center, Colorado's largest public health agency that works specifically with people who inject drugs. We're located right across the street from the Colorado State Capitol, right where we should be.
Yes, absolutely. Also, we just discovered that all three of us are Virgos, which is some people's personal nightmare. Other people might think that's awesome. If you want to get bossed around by three people at the same time,
come on up.
I think this is a good crew to do it.
Beyonce is also a Virgo.
Oh, I know.
So we also get shit done.
She gets everything done.
Just saying.
Exactly. So we're going to talk today about some intertwining things that are should be talked about together, which aren't necessarily talked about, which is mental health and addiction and what that looks like in a city that's growing the way that Denver is and how that's impacting our community in ways that we can see, but also sometimes ways that we don't see. So I'm going to have each of you speak briefly sort of on why I brought you here, which is the Caring for Denver initiative. And then I wanted to sort of use Overdose Awareness Day as a touchstone, but we'll be talking about what Harm Reduction Action Center does. Mm-hmm. So if you want to just introduce, do a little brief on the Caring for Denver ballot initiative that will be on November's ballot this year, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to talk about it. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. Look, I serve on the Judiciary Committee in the state legislature, as well as the Finance and Legal Services Committee. And one thing that we hear time and time again when we're dealing with things like mass incarceration or sentencing reform or jail overcrowding or any of that stuff, we get to mental health and addiction. The number one reason why we have to open new jails in Colorado, which we're fighting against, is because we keep filling them up with people who need access to true services, whether it's mental health or addiction. Our largest mental health facilities in Colorado are our jails and our prisons. That is not okay. And they don't do a good job. And so we need to do better. And so I started looking at kind of what we could do to make a real difference here in Colorado and specifically in Denver, in our neighborhoods, in our communities. And when it came down to it, we needed more resources. And so that's why I moved forward with a ballot initiative called Caring for Denver. For 25 cents on $100, just a quarter on $100, you can provide $45 million worth of mental health and substance abuse treatment right here in Denver. Community-based mental health and substance abuse treatment right here in Denver. When I say treatment, I really mean resources, everything from prevention to intervention to harm reduction, all the way through to recovery. Things that we're not funding, like housing and workforce development as well, because we know how important that is. And so Caring for Denver will do things like ensure that we have a therapist in every school. It'll make sure that we have, I think we're getting some good feedback from the mic here on what I'm saying.
I'm not in charge.
I love it. But also making sure that we actually have a place if we know someone's in crisis, we have a place that we can take them to that's not jail and that's not the ER, where they can go for harm reduction and respite and access to services if they so choose. And so that's what Caring for Denver will do. It's an innovative ballot initiative. We're doing the campaign all through people's stories. So we're using the hashtag #power2 because we all have the power to create change or transform or help, whatever that story is, through just voting yes on Caring for Denver in November. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Okay. Lisa?
So I think when we talk about drug use in our community, I think it's very clear that we have prevention over here, we have treatment over here, and we have the criminalization of drug users here. And all we're simply going to talk about today is the life in the middle. In a very magical world, there would be no drugs, but we live here, and there's one safe thing that folks can do today. And I think we can all agree that if stigma, shame, and incarceration worked with drug use, we'd have wrapped this up years ago. All that's done is drive use underground, where people have gotten preventable chronic diseases such as HIV, hepatitis C, and died of overdose, so we're doing something different. There are 10 syringe access programs in the state of Colorado. We have black tar heroin in Colorado, which is difficult to snort and expensive to smoke, so you almost have to exclusively inject it. So when you hear about heroin in the news and you hear about it in the community, you're specifically hearing about people who inject heroin. The average heroin injector injects 3 to 5 times a day, the average meth injector once or twice a day, and the average cocaine injector 12 to 15 times a day. I want to make sure folks are using new sterile equipment every single time to prevent and eliminate the transmission of HIV and hepatitis C. We have a syringe access program across the street from the Capitol. Like I said, there's 10 in the state. We are the largest. We have over 8,000 folks signed up with us. I see between 120 and 150 people per morning, folks being healthier and safer today. And that's what we can do today, because what we can't do today is get people into substance use treatment. It's impossible. No one in the state of Colorado can get into treatment today. But people are being proactive about their health, and we want to push forward for a healthier and safer them. Overdose is now the leading cause of death of Americans under the age of 50. And in 2017, the preliminary numbers came out. 72,000 folks died of drug overdose deaths in the United States. 1,012 died in the state of Colorado. 201 died in the city and county of Denver. And of that 201, 28 people died of an overdose outside, in alleys, in parks, and in business bathrooms. And we can do better, and I look forward to talking about that tonight.
Thank you so much.
So I just want to talk about that for a second, though. I mean, there is a reality here, which is if we know someone who's in crisis right now, whether it's ourselves, a friend, and they come to you, and they've come to both of us, I'm sure, all of us, and said, I need help today. Our answer is, give me 6 weeks. 4 weeks, maybe. Please don't die. Like, stay safe. Or let's get you into the ER on a 72-hour hold. Or you know what? Go commit a crime, get caught, and I could probably get you in drug court and treatment through that. That is not okay. That is not a solution. It's not humane, and it's not the way that we should treat people in Denver or anyone. And so, you know, I think that it's really important that we think about that. What would we do? We all know people who have gone through crisis or who have needed help. And I'm a state legislator. I can't get people into treatment, right? You work in this field, and you can't get people into treatment today. And so that's why Caring for Denver is so important, because it will change that paradigm. There will be treatment access immediately if we get this passed.
Well, and I think that's what's so important about the conversation is that, so I went through this exact thing, and that's how I met Lisa, was someone close to me came to me and said, I'm a heroin addict. And I started Googling rehab because I didn't know what to do, first of all, because I had never seen heroin. I just had no concept of where I could go or what I could do. And that was what I came up against, was I don't know how to help you other than don't leave my site, which is that what I ended up doing. And I helped somebody home detox, which I don't recommend anybody ever do. It's really intense, and you watch somebody that you love go through hell, and there is something that could probably make them feel better, and it's not what you want to do. So when I found out that this was an initiative, it was kind of like a no duh, but also this is not a conversation that we're having. And Lisa, the way that you talk about it is so important to me, which is people inject drugs. Like, it's not a secret. It shouldn't be a secret. And as I'm a recovering alcoholic of 12 years. I have what I call a socially acceptable addiction, and that I can talk about it and people don't freak out. But when we talk about things like injecting drugs, they get scared. And I think one of the most amazing parts about harm reduction is the idea that there's not just one thing that's gonna happen that's gonna make it be over. So let's figure out what that path is and how to keep you alive. And so I wonder, I would say people in this room maybe are a little bit more liberal in their ideas. If they're coming to this podcast, they're like, okay, cool. Yeah, let's talk about injection drugs. How are we going to talk about this? Or how do you talk about it to folks that maybe don't believe or know necessarily that they have a direct connection to somebody who maybe is in this state?
Well, I will tell you, my job has gotten a lot easier over the years. When I started working in this area, it was through Governor Ritter. I was his senior policy advisor and for human services, and which included his work on behavioral health and anti-recidivism. And I just remember going out on a tour with Urban Peak. We were doing outreach, and I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know what, and it was like, oh, we're just gonna go down the 16th Street Mall, which I go down every day, especially working at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And they were like, these young people are homeless and they need resources and they need services. And I was like, what do you mean? I pass these young people every day and I don't even think about it. You know, I don't even think about it. And that's so many people in Denver. It's like, you just kind of live your life and you don't think about it. But because of the work that so many folks are doing, we're really destigmatizing the conversation. And so the governor was like, I brought you there for a reason. Now we want to work on needle exchange. And we want to make sure that needle exchanges are legal in Colorado, because they weren't legal in Colorado before. And people were still doing the work and they were risking their lives and their freedom in order to keep people alive. That's amazing. And they should never face the threat of jail and confinement just because they're trying to keep other people alive. So that conversation's been going on for a very long time, way before I even started this work, but it's been shifting. And so when we got to this point of talking about safe use sites, when we started talking about things like mental health and substance abuse access, and I said, you know, I wanna do this ballot initiative, how are we gonna do this? How are we gonna make it pass? We started with, like any other campaign, and we started with a poll. And our poll came back at 79% of Denverites saying they support this. 79% of Denver saying, I will put my quarter towards making sure that people have access to the help they need. Mm-hmm. I care and I want to help. I just don't know how. So people have moved from not seeing folks to actually really seeing people, really understanding these issues a little bit, enough to know that we're not doing enough and that if we can do more, if we can give a little bit more, that we should, because it's good for all of us too, right? And so the conversation has really shifted. And now you see people who are, you know, moms in Southmore or former addicts in Five Points or, you know, a new person moving into Rhino saying, this matters to us. Mm-hmm. All very different walks of life, all saying, I get it, this matters, and I wanna help. So it's really to your work and to so many other folks who stood up and told their stories that it's actually really resonating.
That's awesome. That's good to hear, because sometimes it can feel like we're in a vacuum where we're constantly working on this one issue. And though we do see like quick wins or small things happening, it feels like this giant battle is still ahead of us. Lisa, can you talk? I think it's important to maybe demystify or at least break down what harm reduction is. Mm-hmm. And what a safe injection facility is, because I know when I first learned about harm reduction, I was like, why aren't you just trying to get people into treatment? Mm-hmm. Like, well, as we know now, you can't just get people into treatment. So what is harm reduction, and what does it mean when you're meeting people where they are?
So we believe if people want to live a life of recovery, they shouldn't have to live with preventable chronic diseases such as HIV and hepatitis C. We believe if people don't want to live a life of recovery, they shouldn't have to live with preventable diseases such as HIV and hepatitis C, right? So harm reduction is very realistic, and it's very gray in a black and white world, right? So people stand in front of us every morning and want to do something different. And we're creating a relationship with a very marginalized population that when they want to do something different, we're the first folks they come to. And we walk with them on a healthier and safer them today. And we make changes in real time. If you want to get onto Suboxone or methadone, some sort of medication-assisted treatment in Denver, you need to have a valid ID. If you've never had a valid Colorado ID, now we need to get your birth certificate and your Social Security card sent to our place. Then we get you on the ID run. Then your ID comes to our place. Then we can make you the appointment. So there's a lot of baby steps that happen there. But we lose people along the way, too, to incarceration or overdose or, you know, now it's not the right time. We know that if you have a felony in Denver within 7 years, violent or not, you can't get into housing. And it's a very, very tall ask to ask homeless folks to be sober. There's a lot of crisis that happens on the streets, right? So we really meet people where they're at today. And what we like about having a syringe access program and being harm reductionists is that no one's mandated to come to us. We are not parole and probation. We're not like, you know what you should do. How can we support you in walking today? So it's very realistic. And it's on a continuum. We know that managed use is possible, right? People can use opioids and heroin and drugs for years and years and years and do just fine and go to work. I mean, you know, we know that that can happen. We also know that abstinence is a friend of harm reduction. It's just simply not a requirement. And we also know that relapse is part of a recovery for so many people. And so we want to make sure that there's not that shame and stigma that goes along with that so that they don't re-engage. We want to re-engage today. And so what I like about being a harm reductionist is that there's always success, but success looks different to different people. So some folks, that's going to be living a life of recovery, being employed, pushing forward, and doing them. For others, it's going to be somebody who's very fearful of going to the emergency department because there's a deeply entrenched street rumor in Denver that you are going to be warrant checked at the emergency departments. That's false. That's a HIPAA violation, but I can't get folks to reach out for quality health care. So if somebody has abscesses or things like that, I'm like, maybe try using an alcohol pad. Anytime you break your skin, you're at risk of infection. If you use an alcohol pad, you may not get abscesses, which means you may not go into the emergency department. That's success. That's what success looks like. You've gotten your ID and your birth certificate and your social security card, and now you've sent it to our place, and now we're holding on to it for you. So it just, you know, we get to be successful all the time because it's what you want and how we can push forward in real life. So the social impact housing has actually been very powerful for my folks to be able to be housed. You can't work on anything unless you are housed and feel safe and can go to the bathroom inside and feel like you have a safe space in the entire world. Right now, the Harm Reduction Action Center for so many is that one safe space in the entire world they can talk realistically about their drug use. Everywhere else in town, they have to be abstinent or say they want to be abstinent to receive services. You don't have to do that. So we get to cut out a lot of that bullshit, you know, of telling me what you think I want to hear. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me just exactly what you need from me, and we can push forward. So right now, we can give everybody everything they need to prevent and eliminate the transmission of HIV and hepatitis C, syringes, cookers, cottons, tourniquets, that sort of thing. But it's illegal for them to inject on my property. Use and possession on a property can get the property seized. So essentially, we end up sending folks three blocks away to an alley or a business bathroom to inject there, often alone. When we know that heroin injectors are injecting 3 to 5 times a day, when we know cocaine injectors are injecting 12 to 15 times a day, they're injecting outside, in alleys, in parks, and in business bathrooms. And they prioritize business bathrooms first for three reasons. One is that there's a door. If I'm, you know, you don't have to worry about the cops coming up on you in an alley, right, if you have a door. The second is so kids don't see them, and they're very clear about that. And then the third main reason is having access to sterile water. When you inject, all drugs need to be made as blood-like as possible. When you have a hard time getting access to water, it doesn't mean that you don't inject. It means you use toilet tank water, river water, or saliva. And there's a lot of crap in your mouth in particular and bacteria, and so that's no good. If I am Hep C positive and I have some water and I've injected with it and you need water and I give you that water, that's how folks a lot of times are getting hepatitis C. We know hepatitis C lives in injecting water for 62 days. They know not to share the syringes, but the other equipment is very difficult to come by unless they're going to a syringe access program. So have we got an idea for you people? It's called supervised consumption sites or overdose prevention sites or supervised use sites or whatever you want if we can get one. So what this does is take injecting out of the public sphere and put it into a controlled environment. So they're simply set up as booths. They're stainless steel. The drugs are pre-obtained. They are not bought or sold on site. And people come in and inject themselves. So it's simply a program arm of an already flourishing syringe access program. We have the infrastructure and the relevancy of people who inject drugs, but instead of sending them outside to alleys and parks and business bathrooms, we actually want to bring them inside. And so what happens is that it reduces the acquisition of HIV and hepatitis C because folks don't share or reuse any of the equipment. It reduces skin tissue infections because you have that moment to use that alcohol pad. We also know skin tissue infections are about $6,000 a day in Denver emergency departments alone. So we're all paying for that. Alcohol pads cost a penny. It has proper syringe disposal right there. The disposals are there. And in 10 countries, 63 cities, and 102 total sites internationally, no one's ever died of an overdose there because there's been a trained professional there to recognize and respond. And it's not just heroin overdoses. If you can intervene in a stimulant overdose, and they often present as a heart attack, stroke, or seizure, and so we're talking about cocaine, crack, or meth, people can be alive. And when people are alive, there's hope. Because dead drug users do not have the opportunity for recovery. And we need to push forward with a healthier and safer them today.
Thank you. Yeah, when I learned about this from you, it made so much sense to me. And I think of it sort of the way that certain other healthcares are kept out of reach of some folks, whether that's economically, or I even just think about when I was an uninsured person and the sort of... the decisions that you make, like, can I pay for this or can I do this? Like, having to negotiate your life every day, it's like very stressful but sometimes to the outside world, that's hard to see. Mm-hmm. We're just seeing somebody on the street. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing, like, I mean, this goes for anybody that you pass every day. You don't know what they're going through. So something else that you brought up was housing people is so crucial. Mm-hmm. Where will Caring for Denver, where does that sort of come into the picture? Because to me, housing is the biggest issue in Denver, and it intersects with all of these other things, but it's why people are unwell, why people are unemployed, why people are in abusive situations because they don't have somewhere to live. So how is this going to impact or hopefully have some sort of intersection there?
Yeah, well, I think with our partners, amazing partners such as Colorado Coalition for the Homeless and others, Caring for Denver will help to provide funding and grant opportunities for those organizations to come and say, we want to provide supportive housing for folks who are living with mental illness or addiction. And that is something that we can fund. That is something that Caring for Denver will be able to support and fund, youth and adults. So Urban Peak can come and say, we want to do this innovative housing model for our young people, and we need help, we need services, and we need funding, and we could help provide that funding. So the Caring for Denver Fund will go a long way into ensuring that we have so many of the critical services that people need to save lives, mm-hmm. to save lives. And, you know, we've talked about this Safe Youth Site conversation for a while, and, you know, people just get a little taken aback by it. They are illegal right now in Colorado, so we can't have them now. But the number one thing that kept coming up was, well, but what about access to treatment? Mm-hmm. What about access to help? There's not enough treatment. So how are you going to allow this and then not provide the treatment? And I don't think that that's an unreasonable argument.
Right.
It's not an unreasonable argument. And while everyone doesn't go to treatment, there should be some type of resources for anyone mm-hmm. who we have access to who says that they need help. I don't care if that's socks and food.
Right.
There needs to be something there. And so the work that Lisa is doing is so amazing. It is woefully unfunded and under-resourced. And Caring for Denver can help with that too. So it's the gamut from harm reduction to housing, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how, Lisa, can you talk a little bit about, like, ideally, if you could house all of your people that you see every day, what sorts of things would change? Do you like, how would you see that impacting the city for the better? Because that's kind of what I see is I just, when I see people, I think how much better would their lives be if they were housed and how would that impact the rest of us?
So of the 8,000 folks that have signed up with us, 76% of our folks are homeless or transitionally housed upon intake. And when we talk about transitionally housed, that means folks that go into shelters. So when we talk about homeless, we're primarily talking about street homeless, only because they stay on the streets because they can't use in the shelters. And if you've ever been to any of the overnight men's shelters in Denver, the doors are off the bathroom stalls, which is a dignity issue, but also, you know, they're afraid people are going to overdose there and die of overdoses, and people do die of overdoses in our shelters. So we also know that a really good harm reduction method that our folks use in the winter is to inject meth so they can walk around the city all night so they don't lay down and freeze to death so they don't have to go into the shelters. That's a harm reduction method, right? We also know that young women will inject meth to not have to partner up with some guy in a DV situation to be able to feel safe all night too. So when people have access to housing and have a safe space, then they can start working on everything else. When you know where you're gonna go, be able to go to the bathroom, you know, going to the bathroom is very difficult. I was homeless for 7 months. months I lived in a van, but my husband and I are homeless. And bathroom stuff is weird, people. I'm not going to lie to you. And doing it in parking lots is very difficult. And there's a lot of shame that goes along with bathroom stuff outside, too. So we can talk about that if you want. But then getting inside, too, is also can help to reduce their drug use. You know, it's not so chaotic. But what we do often see is when our folks are housed, then they're using alone, which is one of the four main reasons why people overdose in our communities, because no one's there to recognize and respond. So a lot of times, you know, drug users have access to naloxone in our community, as they should, because drug users are the true first responders in the midst of this overdose epidemic. They're there to save each other's lives. But once somebody gets housed, they're out of that community now, which actually puts them at higher risk of overdosing and dying because nobody's there to be able to save them. So we get really torn a lot of times, too, when people do get housed because we worry about their safety. And in a lot of the housing, you can't be using drugs. We also know that to get Suboxone, which is part of medication-assisted treatment in Denver, there are two places that won't prescribe to homeless folks. Mm-hmm. So I've got to be the jerk on the front end that's like, oh, you want Suboxone? Okay, do you have an ID? Oh, you do? Do you have health insurance? Oh, shit balls, things popping. Are you housed? Oh, okay. You know, so housing is substance use treatment in our community. If we want a healthier and safer community and we want to invest in public safety, we need to be investing in all sorts of things, and housing is just one of them.
That's right. And something I learned from a social worker that I had on the show last month was that when folks are housed, they're obviously more likely to check, you know, be checked back in with if they have a social worker that they're working with or a therapist. Like, it's not really top of mind for someone to be like, oh, I need to go to therapy when you don't have a house mm-hmm. or you don't know where you're going to go. Mm-hmm. So having, I think sometimes as housed people, we take routine for granted and how much that impacts our health and how stability in our housing allows us to do all of these other things, whether it's go to work or care for someone else on top of ourselves or care for, you know, I mean, just like all these things that I think that we don't think about because we're housed. Mm-hmm. But another thing I wanted to get into, because you brought this up, is the incarceration component and sort of where the justice system is, and sort of if both of you could see ideal outcomes from what you're working on, what would that mean for folks that are incarcerated or just the system in general?
Yeah, well, I think at the end of the day, I'm looking to end mass incarceration. Right? I'm looking to ensure that we don't have a prison industrial complex that is profiting off of the backs of folks who are down on their luck or incarcerated. I want to make sure that we have a criminal justice system that is just and fair. And so that is something that I don't think seems so far away, but definitely is, right? It's definitely something that people don't think about, because it's easy to say, well, they did that, so they deserve this. You know, they deserve this. You don't think about the over-policing issue. You don't think about the trauma in our communities. You don't think about the housing or the reason why people have made the decisions that they've made, or the fact that so many have made them and not gotten caught either, you know? And so incarcerating people does not keep our communities safe, period. It does not. We are the number one incarcerator in the world by multiples. Right? And we are not the safest country in the world, right? So it's not working. And so we have to look at things differently. So when we look at things like caring for Denver, we do want to make sure that the criminal justice system, law enforcement, first responders, the DAs, the city attorney, sheriffs are all on board with a model where we can work together to move forward. And so part of caring for Denver is ensuring that we have things like co-responders. That's that's mental health professionals who ride along with law enforcement officers, so that if someone is in crisis, they're able to make a better decision, a more informed decision about what should happen with that person. So when a law enforcement officer responds to a scene, say it's domestic violence, or say it's related to a mental health crisis, they have a professional with them right there who can identify it, who can say, here's the help that this person really needs, and here's how we can make this situation safer. That has shown to reduce violence in our communities. That has shown to reduce the use of jails in our communities. And it's shown to keep people safe. But on the flip side, which is the unintended positive consequence of co-responders, is that it actually also reduces the unneeded and harmful use of force by police officers, because excessive use of force, because they are riding along with a mental health professional too. And they are getting the help that they need every single day. And they need it. We all need it. They definitely need it. And so, and they have guns. And so it's important. It's important that we make sure that they get access to mental health services. And let me tell you, being a law enforcement officer, you have so much stigma around needing help for what you see on the job every single day that you don't often get it. And if you don't get it, you respond to incidences in a deadly way. In a deadly way. And so we need to make sure that we have co-responders on the scene. And when we do, we have so many positive impacts in our communities. But then also law enforcement starts to get it. Like, this is not as simple as what it seems. Let's dig beneath the surface a little bit. Let's respond differently. That makes such a difference. And so we do have the DA on board. We do have the chief of police saying we need to have a new model. We need to do things differently. Part of Caring for Denver will go to law enforcement assistant diversion programs. We've seen them work in other states, in other cities, in other countries, and we need to have more of a concerted effort here. What does that look like? That means when we have our frequent flyers, the folks who are often in jail and going back maybe between Lisa's Place and jail and Civic Center Park, that they have a response team around them that meets on a regular basis and talks about all these. Have you seen Jill? Have you talked to her? Is she okay? Who's seen her? Who hasn't? Is she in your system? Have we cleared her warrant out? You know, how is she doing in recovery? Has she relapsed? What do we need to get her? Is she hanging out with that guy again? You know, those kind of conversations happen when you bring everyone to the table. I tend to believe that the people who are working in this area actually do care about people. They actually do care about, whether you're law enforcement, whether you're a provider, whether you're a nonprofit, whatever it is, they do get in this work because they care. But there's conditions that put you in your shell, right? Or put you in your box. And the more that folks are able to get together and have conversations about how they can really provide help to some of our neighbors who maybe are the frequent flyers, that's when we're really making a difference. And so law enforcement assisted diversion puts everyone at the table together and says, what can we do to help Jill? What do we need to get her the services she needs?
Well, and you put it in a really great way, because this was the conversation last month was about this very thing, which was co-responders. And, you know, I'm an abolished police person. I just don't believe that we need to have police. But I also understand in this current situation, we can't just, it just doesn't stop. And then if we were able to do that, what would be the next day? You know, so like starting somewhere is that to me. And it's a struggle, I think, sometimes with when I'm talking about this with my friends that are definitely even more to that side of abolished police, where it's like, how do we even trust them? How do we trust the mental health professionals that are with the police? How, you know what I mean? It's like, you're right. I don't know how we do that other than really hope that if we can, like, you just, the thought of an officer having to be with a mental health professional all the time, I'd probably be speaking that therapy talk too, you know, at some point if that was my coworker. But I mean, that's like, that's a start, right? Right. I mean, well, that's a start, and we have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I know that helps people from going back into jail, which we've learned does not help, you know.
And yes, and I think what's really important is law enforcement knows they cannot arrest their way out of this epidemic. Mm-hmm. And they have said so. And they've started shifting to public health even more than healthcare providers. So right now on the front lines of the overdose epidemic are emergency departments, law enforcement, and syringe access programs. We are working together in a way that we never have before. And the gateway drug that we can all get around is naloxone. It keeps people alive in the event of an opioid overdose. Not only can opioid users have access in our community, but third parties as well. People around people at risk of an opioid overdose. Mothers, homeless service providers, me, law enforcement. So 178 law enforcement departments in the state are carrying naloxone. There's 5 county jails that train heroin users in jail how to recognize and respond to an overdose and put that naloxone in their property for upon release. So there has been this shift with law enforcement knowing they can't arrest their way out of it. We've had 19 referrals to our program from law enforcement. DPD has dropped folks off out front and been like, here, they'll help you. And we're like, okay, get out of here. Thank you. But we also need to have a relationship partnership with law enforcement as a syringe access program because we can't have them sitting out front and profiling like they do in other states. We also have a lieutenant on our board of directors with the Denver Police Department, so it's important that we push forward together. Now, we don't agree on a lot, but there are some things that we do agree on, that we want to have proper syringe disposal. And for the longest time, folks were catching 8 to 15 days in county jail per syringe, sterile or used in Denver.
So that you just had one on your person.
Yep.
And so the police.
Yep. Sterile or used. I was like, I get the, but sterile, come on. Well, and you want to be, you know, more careful about the used ones. And so it would promote improper disposal. I'd want to get it off me, right? And when cops deem an area a high drug traffic area, and Speer and Colfax used to be the largest drug dealing corner in the city, it's no longer, that was deemed a high drug traffic area. So folks were inappropriately disposing. So we went out and caused a ruckus and caused a scene per the use. Some people in the community think I'm an advocate, others think I'm a nag, whatever. And so we got an outdoor kiosk where you can dispose properly of your syringes 24/7. And in the first year that we had it there at the largest drug dealing corner in the city, 1,500 syringes were appropriately disposed there. And that's City of Denver numbers. That's not my numbers. I was just hoping 20 would get in there, right? So when people have opportunities, they want to do the right thing. But when there's all these barriers that you're going to get, you know, in trouble by law enforcement. And we also know that 1/3 of law enforcement officers nationally will be pricked by a syringe at some point in their career. 2/3 of that 1/3 will be pricked multiple times. So when we have syringe decriminalization, it promotes proper syringe disposal in the community and reduces needle stick injuries with law enforcement. So it becomes a real win-win to be able to push forward together. Because law enforcement knows we have black tar heroin and knows that people are injecting and knows that this is happening and wants a safe space that people can go to and access resources and referrals.
So basically what you're saying is that instead of incarcerating people, which didn't work, or arresting them and putting them in jail for a few hours and then them coming back out, the way that it actually worked was to provide a receptacle for people to put their syringes. Mm-hmm. Genius. So the way that we actually kept law enforcement even more safe and our community and people who were walking on Speer and Colfax, you said, was to make sure that they had a place to go and to put things. This is common sense, people. But for so long, we've created policies that just said, nope, you did something wrong, you're going to jail. And you're going to get out and you're going to do it again, but that's fine. We're just going to keep putting you in jail. It's a revolving door until something else happens to you. That is not okay, but it's also not working and it's not safe.
And we're going to brand you as a felon, right? So you can't get a job or housing or in some states food, but get out there, buddy, and flourish.
Yeah, and you bootstraps, people.
Bootstraps. You got it.
And you're going to be stigmatized for multiple reasons, just based on how you exist in the world and where you, you know,
and
how you
present
yourself.
Why aren't you flourishing? I'm so confused.
Right. Why don't you just get it together? Yeah. So what people don't realize too is that recovery is not a straight line. So once you've done a program or once you've gotten access to treatment, if you can, and if you can get it and you can afford it and you've gotten the right program and it worked for you, that doesn't mean that you are forever going to be sober. That doesn't mean that your work is done on yourself or on what you're doing. I think that's so important because people think that. People think, oh, you went through a program, you've gotten your shot, you're good to go. Life isn't going to be amazing for you.
You'll never be triggered. Nothing will ever stressful will ever happen to you ever again.
No, you'll be good. Yeah. You've got your one shot. So take like, and that's it. And that's just not the case. And so we have to look at harm reduction. We have to look at recovery. And as a legislator, I have a legislator who works on Colfax, right? That's where the Capitol building is.
Colfax doesn't run itself, people.
Colfax. I have Narcan on my desk. Mm-hmm. In the Capitol, and it's so important to make sure that we know how to use it and that we are able to save people's lives.
Absolutely. Another piece I want to talk about is the mental health component, because I think that's underlying again it in so many things that we don't talk about. Again, I was uninsured for I think 8 or 9 years, and then when I was able to get on Medicaid, it literally changed my life. Before I was trying to go to therapy, but it was like, oh, this is sliding scale and you can see a student therapist person maybe who just wants to talk to you about their lives. Weird. But like, there's all these like, you know, or you can pay $90. That's like the cheap one. And it was like, I can't do this is like not feeding me or putting gas in my car or paying my bills. So it's probably not going to be a high priority. But once I was able to get into the Mental Health Center of Denver, it changed my life. And so I think about all of the people I know who are struggling with, and I hate to say struggling because sometimes we are just existing and it's cool, but and something I shared with you earlier was I lost my friend Colin Ward earlier this year to suicide, and I think about how many of these things that we've talked about tonight impacted his life, and maybe I wouldn't say everything is a direct goes, you know, everything that happens to us is a result and manifests in some way. And he lost his housing, and then he lost his stability, and it. I think about like how we didn't do enough. We didn't, you know, we weren't there enough. We didn't do enough. But in reality, like that's just what happened. But what if he could have seen somebody? What if he could have gone to therapy or could have seen, you know, like just had a little bit more help? And I wonder how does Caring for Denver going to address that? Because it's kind of just this nebulous thing like therapy or support or, you know, mental health. Like what is that going to look like through this initiative?
Well, I wish I would have known Colin.
I wish you would have too.
I have heard so many amazing things about Colin, and I will tell you that he has sparked something in people to really get active and work on this issue. Colin will save lives. And I will tell you that we have partnered with the Mental Health Center of Denver, as well as the Museum of Contemporary Arts. And we are looking to ensure that there are resources in places that people go normally, right? Where they go every day. And that looks like the Museum of Contemporary Art, where people feel safe, where they feel like they belong. It's like their space. There would be resources provided there. That could be an art workshop. That could be talking about depression and suicide and other mental health issues right there. And then connecting folks to Mental Health Center of Denver when they need to or if they need to, but also just making sure that the conversation is not as hidden as it has been, and doing it in a safe place that people can identify with. That's why Caring for Denver is unique, is because it does provide those community-based resources. So whether you see something happening at the mental at the Museum of Contemporary Art or at the Westwood Community Center or at the Blair Caldwell Library, that's where you're going to start to see a shift in the conversation. That's where we'll be able to fund programming where people can say, you know what, I come here all the time. Mostly I come here when I'm looking for solitude or when I'm looking for a place to belong, and I just kind of, this is where I end up all the time. That's where you're going to feel safe enough to start having a conversation about what you're going through. And so that's what this will do. And I know that the reason why the Museum of Contemporary Art and Adam Lerner personally has got involved is because of Colin and so many folks that he's inspired. So,
yeah, thank you. That's so cool, too, to think about being able to go somewhere like the museum or like a library, these spaces that, like you're saying, like, you know, we know the library is a safe space for a lot of people. Yeah. At the main library, they have social workers now. My friend Christy just left there. She was a social worker there. Now she's in the jails. And it was a lot for her as a person, just the sheer volume of folks that she was seeing every day. So if we were able to see those services throughout the city, I mean, it would ease the burden for those people that are doing this work, but also make it more available to more people.
I'll just add to, that's right. I mean, think about it though. I mean, there's so much we can do with this fund. We have these school-based health centers, and someone takes their kid to this health center. There's only a couple in Denver. They're not in every school. And then they get access to treatment for themselves, right? So sometimes the only time someone is going to go get primary care, for instance, is because they took their child there first, mm-hmm. right? Because their child is one number one important thing. And then they get access. Well, what if these centers, some do, but what if more were able to offer that mental health and mental health treatment or just conversation? Because you're right. You know, when some of us are struggling and going through tough times, I can't afford $200 three times a week to go see a therapist.
Right.
It's not going to happen, you know? And so where do I go? Where would we go? If you could have that in the schools and it's destigmatized and it's where you take your kid every day, I think you'll have more likelihood of accessing those services. And I think your kid will too. I think that's so important because we'll just be talking about this differently, you know, just changing the whole paradigm. And it happens through starting with Caring for Denver, but there's so much more that we can do.
Lisa, can you talk a little bit about your folks and where you see the intersection of mental health and drug use?
So I want to be very clear that not all people that use drugs have mental health issues, and not all people with mental health issues use drugs. I just want to be very clear about that. We also know that people can use drugs and can be problematic users or non-problematic users too. So, you know, you will never hear me talk about addiction because there is so much that goes into that. I'm working with drug users. I do have a lot of people who are schizophrenic or have schizoaffective disorder because nothing dulls the voices quite like heroin. We also know that folks in and out of incarceration actually get pretty good mental health and get on meds while they're incarcerated, and then we'll get a 30-day supply when they leave, but then won't do follow-up care, you know, just because life can be very chaotic, especially if you're homeless or transitionally housed. And so then a lot of times folks will go back to that. So like I have somebody who hears voices so loudly that he goes like this in his ear and blood comes out of his ear. I have somebody else who can't really hear me unless he's looking at me because the voices are so loud. So it's tricky for folks too, because now you're navigating life not only as somebody potentially, you know, with a mental health issue, especially with schizophrenia, but then trying to like buy drugs. Excuse me, good sir, you know. And so may I have some of those drugs, please? So I know that can be very difficult for them too. And then there's a lot of violence that happens in our community against homeless folks that are specifically by housed people. And a lot of times, homeless folks will not report the crime for a couple reasons. One is if you have a warrant and you report a crime, they're gonna warrant check you. So you potentially going and reporting a crime, you could get arrested. And people on the streets know that you are snitching, right? That could be very dangerous for you too. So there's a lot of that crisis management that happens for our folks. So sometimes, you know, so we are 9 to noon for drop-in, but we do things all day there. I get there about 7:30, and sometimes I'll have somebody sitting on the front step that is like, I had a bad night. This is not good. Come on in. Let's talk about it. What can we do? So a lot of it's that crisis management. The problem is if you call the crisis service line in Colorado, a lot of times if you are a threat to yourself or others, they want to send the cops. Mm-hmm. Well, my folks don't want that, right? So they're going to hang up and they're going to leave because they are do not want to be arrested, but are going to still a threat to themselves or others. And a long time ago, when I was a baby harm reductionist and I thought I could change the world, I'm just trying to change Denver now. If I had somebody that was having a mental health issue, I'd put them in my car and try to get them on a 72-hour hold. And if you're a drug user with a mental health issue, they're going to pop you into detox. So 72 hours later, you get out of detox. You are still a threat to yourselves or others. And you're in withdrawal, so you're dope sick. And you're mad at me because I thought we could change something. So I don't even try to put them into a 72-hour hold anymore either. So when I have folks reaching out in an insane time and trying to reach out for quality care, we have very little to be able to bring folks to. And I'm not a 72-hour hold kind of gal, but when people are saying, I need help, or I'm suicidal and I'm trying to get them to the emergency department, but they don't want to go to the emergency department because they think they're going to be warrant checked, they're roaming our streets all night trying to figure out what to do next. And so there's just a lot of those barriers that come up where it's just like, well, why can't they just get mental health treatment if that's what they want? Some mental health therapists won't work with folks to resolve trauma unless they're abstinent. Well, sometimes why the fuck do you think they're using drugs? So, you know, so that becomes frustrating. They get a case of the fuckets. Nobody cares. So why should I care? And continue pushing forward. So what I like about our place in particular is that we're re-engaging folks as a part of a community. Because when you're homeless and you're a drug user, you're very siloed and you're on the go and you have a lot of trust issues. We want to reclaim you to be you can be a good community member. And there's a few things that you have to do to be able to be there. And they go out of their way to be loving, kind, and generous to themselves and to each other in our space. We have 8,000 folks in the last 6 years, and I see 120 to 150 people per morning. We've only kicked out 15 people for life, which we feel like is pretty good, considering they go out of their way to be loving, kind, and generous. Most have been incarcerated at one point or another. They've had to front for their needs, and you can't do that in there. There's a behavior change that happens in there too. So there's a lot of things that happen when people find a safe space.
You know, and I've traveled around a lot in the U.S. and also in Canada, looking at different models for how we can deal with this issue. And what I learned, something that really, really stuck out at me was the best time to have a conversation with someone about recovery or about treatment is right after they use. It's not when they're coming down and they're dope sick. It's not when they've detoxed. It's when they've just finally got that fix and they say, this is my last time. And someone is there who can have a conversation with them and then help them to go to wherever they need to go, wherever is appropriate for them. And it's usually not a zero tolerance type place. Mm-hmm. But that's the best time. So let's think about that. Like, our whole model is not working because it's based on stigma and lies and shame. And it's killing people. It's killing people. So we need people like Lisa who are willing to have that conversation right then. Right then, because that's the best time to get people into treatment, into recovery, or even just into a safe place.
That's so interesting. I never thought about it that way, but it makes total sense because, you know, they're in a good space in that moment. And if someone, like, you know, one of us can help them, we have to be there without judgment. And that requires us to not judge the fact that somebody maybe just injected drugs. And they're still the same person that they were before they did that. And they're still going to be the same person after they did that. So we're coming up on the end of this, but I was wondering if each of you could just share a little personal story or information about why you're working on what you're working on right now.
Don't be shy.
Good point. Well, I want to tell you a lot of things. I can't believe we're almost over.
I know.
It's way past my bedtime on a Thursday night. Okay, so there's a couple of things. So first, next Friday, August 31st, is International Overdose Awareness Day. This is a time that we mourn those that we've lost and fight like hell for those still with us. So I just wanted to make sure to put that on your radar, that we're going to be raising a ruckus. It is the Friday of Labor Day weekend, and Taste of Colorado always fences off my favorite areas, but I'm going to be really cool about it. If you want to meet at the Harm Reduction Action Center at 1 o'clock, we're going to raise a ruckus. Would love to have you.
Where can you tell us where you are?
Oh, sure. 231 East Colfax, between Sherman and Grant on the north side. I'm running the north side of Colfax and State Patrol's running the south side. And Colfax does not run itself, people.
The bus does.
The bus does. Oh my gosh, that bus. So we also need folks to really push forward with us to join our business and service provider coalition, because we will get a supervised consumption site in Denver.
Which is a place where people can go inject drugs safely.
Simply a program arm of an already flourishing syringe access program in your community, which takes injecting out of the public sphere and puts it into a controlled environment. So we want you to join us on that movement as well. I have information tonight where you can sign up as a business support. Hope Tank is a business supporter. Thank you so much, Hope Tank, and we have a lot of folks on Broadway in particular. We have about 50 businesses that have signed on that say, yes, I'm tired of being a bathroom monitor and I'd like to try this in our community. We also have the faith community, recovery, treatment, moms, drug users, medical providers, Colorado Medical Society, Denver Medical Society. Law enforcement and district attorneys are neutral. That's great. That's exactly where we need them. So I'd love for you to push forward with us as well. And then I think we just really want to let you know that the Harm Reduction Action Center is there not only for people who inject drugs, but we know for family members who struggle, and especially for family members who have lost folks to overdose, who oftentimes, due to stigma and shame, can't talk about it, that you can email me a picture of somebody and we'll frame it and put it on our overdose memorial wall. That wall is particularly powerful because that is a space where, you know, when people come in and tour, they're able to kind of get that face. A lot of times for folks who are active users now, they don't want to do a lot of media and things like that because it often brands them later on if they're wanting to live a life of recovery. So it can kind of ebb and flow to getting active users. And then what's really great is, so 5 of the 8 employees at the Harm Reduction Action Center are current and former injectors. So it's very important that we reflect the community in which we serve. And so one of my coworkers recently had said that, you know, the wall continues to grow, and it does, because we continue to lose people in the midst of this overdose epidemic. but he also wanted to start a Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life is for folks that have survived an overdose. And they can put their name on a leaf, the overdose date, because everybody knows that date, and then saying something that I survived. So we're really, really excited about that for folks, because it's having a lot of really great conversations with our folks too, because a lot of times we are just so glad they're here today. When people come in, with 8,000 people, I really don't know anybody's name anymore. Hey, you, I'm glad to see you. I'm glad you're here. I've missed you. I've never really asked people where they've been, because that's none of my fucking business. But you're here today, and we're going to push forward for a healthier and safer you. And we might watch a movie. They watched Roadhouse this morning. I got them to watch Fried Green Tomatoes yesterday. Oh my goodness. And then Rudy one time, and I couldn't do anything else, and I had to sit and watch Rudy. So there's a lot of life that happens between prevention and treatment. And that's why I'm really, really thankful that Caring for Denver has been very supportive to making sure that harm reduction is there in the forefront, because we're there every single day. When some people can't, and I totally get that. Some people can't be in people's lives, and I get that. But I have the luxury of being able to do this every day, and I can't imagine being anywhere else. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm in this work for a lot of reasons, but I will tell you that the reason why I have been looking at mass incarceration and addiction and the interconnection of substance abuse and mental health and incarceration is because of my sister. So I grew up, my mom's in the military. I was born in Germany, lived all around the world with my brother. And my mom actually left Oakland, California, left a husband who they didn't have a great marriage. Her first child, my sister, stayed with her father, wanted to finish school. She was in high school. My mom, you know, kind of moved on, married my father, had me and my brother. We went through a whole different life, right? Not too long after my mom married my dad and kind of did her thing, my sister got pretty addicted to drugs. And she was in and out of the criminal justice system. Oftentimes we didn't know where she was. We didn't know what state she was in. We didn't know if she showed up where we were because she was on the run or because she wanted help or because she was allowed to be there. And that was my life with her. We didn't know if she was alive sometimes. And seeing that and knowing that she didn't have access to the actual services that she needed, knowing that she was in the criminal justice system under zero tolerance and three strikes you're out type policies, and knowing there was a addiction issue underlying that, that no one ever gave her services for, or she never got treatment for, it's frustrating, and it's also quite helpless. Like I felt very helpless. Like, what can we do to make this better? And after you're in once or twice, especially with these zero tolerance policies, you're done, right? You're not going to get housing. You're not going to get the help that you need. Your children are going to continue to be taken away from you for any kind of altercation or anything that happens. And that was my sister's life. And I saw it on a regular basis. Not long ago, I talked to my sister and she told me about the sexual trauma she faced around that same time when she was a teenager, about 16. And that's what started the drug use and not getting, not even being able to talk about that trauma, not even be able to tell anyone until she's in her 40s about it. And even the ones that she probably did tell and didn't know how to help her or didn't say what she needed to hear or didn't know what to do. And so she turned to drugs pretty quickly. And so I do this work for my sister. I do this work for so many of our family, our siblings, our friends who just really didn't have that help that they needed, right? That really didn't have someone who said, I see you and I want to help. I believe you deserve a real chance. I'm not going to label you. That is why I do this work. And I will always do this work. I will continue to fight. And, you know, I'm glad that my sister and I talk quite frequently now. And one thing that I think is interesting, and we're kind of like piecing all this together in our adulthood right now, because you know, I'm in obviously in politics, and my brother actually is an anesthesiologist, and I talked to him about why he does the work that he's doing, and it's because he said, I want to help people deal with pain in a different way. It's the same reason, right? We're all fighting for my sister. And I think that well, it's why I do what I do. Mm-hmm. It's why I will continue to do this work and why I think we have to look at it from that real personal level. And so caring for Denver is personal for me. It's personal for so many of us. And that's why we need to make sure it passes in November.
A couple things I would love for you guys to do when you leave here. Think about somebody in your life you could have a conversation with about injection drug use that you maybe didn't think you could have that conversation with. I try to think of the people that it would be most difficult to have this, to talk freely about drug use with, and it's like, think, can I do that? Can I have this conversation? Because coming from me, will this change their mind just for, you know, or maybe in the future? Because I think about how much my mind has been changed, even as an addict, since meeting you and understanding and going to the harm reduction. I love the Harm Reduction Action Center. It's like, I see people feel, we take for granted so much what it feels like to be welcome, when, especially if you're somebody who is ignored a lot. And that's another thing that I would love folks to think about, is when you see folks on the street in whatever capacity, are you just like saying what's up to them? Even if they're asking you for money or whatever, I think about this, some, they don't, if you're just like, hey, how's it going? They're a person. They're going to go, hey, mm-hmm. how's it going? And that can be the extent of your exchange. And changing my mind around that has changed my whole attitude about how I can do better as a person in this city. The other thing I would love for folks to do is learn more about this initiative mm-hmm. and tell other people, because voting is like, it's frustrating. I totally get it. It feels like fuck this sometimes, fuck yeah other times. So try to like take that information. And again, personal stories change people's perceptions more than you will ever know. It's the reason that I do the work that I do right now, is I started a column for Westword, and my first story was about getting diarrhea in yoga class. And now here I am. But like, you know,
I made it.
But what I found through that column over 6 years was just talking about my real life made other people feel less stigmatized about whatever they're going through in their situation. And that was suicide, drug use, mental health issues, alcoholism. But, you know, like just basic things that we think we talk about every day, especially with social media. But when we're face to face with somebody and we're having that conversation. So check out the Harm Reduction Action Center. Please follow Caring for Denver. You can find them all on social media. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much to the Hope Tank and yes. Erica. This store yes. fucking rules. And a business owner that wants us to come in and talk about injection drug use is a fucking awesome person. So, and Erica said you get 10% off tonight if you want to purchase.
Yeah, and we're technically closed.
Yes.
And I don't want to torture.
Yes, again. Yes.
So, but if you want to do a fast shop, yes.
Okay.
Also,
come
I
back.
I'll just give you 10% discount to come back.
Perfect. Ooh. Thank you. Cool. Okay. Could give like 5 minutes for questions if anybody has any. Okay.
No, you're good.
Okay. Does anybody have a question? If you don't, yeah. Do you want
to?
Oh, wait. Sorry. Can you come up here?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no. For Lisa, with the controlled consumption mm-hmm. sites, you said it was already in other countries.
Uh-huh.
And it's proven successful with that mm-hmm. so far? Okay.
Yes.
Just a confirmation.
Yes. So there, thankfully, it's very counterintuitive, obviously, much like syringe access programs. So it's been heavily researched. So there's a lot of data that has come out of these countries to show quite a few things. It doesn't increase crime in the neighborhood. It doesn't initiate new folks into injection drug use. So it's already people that are using. It decreases the acquisition of HIV and hepatitis C. People don't die of overdoses there. It promotes proper syringe disposal. And it's another link into getting folks into treatment. When we can keep people alive, there's hope, and when there's hope, we can be able to push forward. So there's a ton of data and evidence. One of our volunteers, Aaron, has brought his binder, which is underneath his chair. I also Whoa. Carry a binder as well, because there's so much data and evidence. Wave your freak flag. Thank you. Is that because it's so counterintuitive a lot of times for folks that they have a hard time thinking, oh my gosh, they must have just made this up. And it's like, there's a lot of data and evidence to prove that it works. And so we're really excited about that. I'm glad you said something.
Just really quick though, what is the next step to getting that in Denver?
So what is the next step to getting a safe injection site in Denver?
So we plan to be in front of City Council this fall to do an ordinance change that would go into effect with statewide legislation. And we are looking to 2019... statewide legislation with this gal pal.
You're so subtle. Doing
I got my subtle face on today. And so in 2019, we will pass statewide legislation. And so then it would go into effect in the city. And then we will probably continue to be out of federal compliance. However, there's a lot of things out of federal compliance and, you know, the feds. So we want to be able to push forward by mid next year. That's our big plan.
So if you go
and
to
so
city,
that means you can come and testify. So when it comes before city council, you can come and testify. When it comes before the state house, you can come testify before the committees. You can write letters. You can get involved in that way. You can talk to your neighborhood associations and kind of dispel some of the myths that we feel gut in our guts about this issue. Even the most supportive of us are like, ooh, but is that the right way? Does that really work? I've seen them work. I've been there. I've been to safe use sites. I've sat with them. I've sat with people and peer specialists who then are helping others to navigate. It works. It works. And so have this conversation, reduce the stigma, and really get to the fact that this will save lives.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you guys so much. This has been so Thank wonderful.
You. Thank you.
Oh, and I'm on both of your newsletters. That's a really great way because you don't send a ton of it. But if you just want to harmreductionactioncenter.org and then caringfordenver.org.
caringfordenver.com and it's number four.
Okay.
And you can follow me on my rep pages as well. Representative Leslie Herod, H-E-R-O-D.
Cool. Thank you guys. Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you, Hope Tank.
Thank you so much, Bree.
Mutiny Transmissions is a media service that provides podcasts, video, and live shows recorded inside and outside of Mutiny Information Cafe, located at 2 South Broadway in Denver, Colorado.